today, Vetrano versus the United States.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, Counsel. My name is Robert O'Reilly, and I represent the petitioner appellant Thomas Vetrano. This is our second trip up here on a motion to amend a habeas petition, our first motion to amend the habeas petition. The first go-round, Judge Randa ruled that he did not have jurisdiction to entertain the motion to amend the habeas petition, ruling that a second or successive petition. This court reversed that, remanded it, and said that he should decide whether to permit the amendment of the habeas petition on the merits. He denied that. He ruled that the motion was brought in bad faith. And frankly, for me, that's the part that I have the most problems with. The motion to amend did two things. The first thing was that it added a claim under Chambers and Begay that basically said that none of Mr. Vetrano's previous convictions would be qualified as predicate offenses under Chambers or Begay for the Armed Career Criminal Act. He's got two convictions for reckless endangerment. He's got one conviction for escape when he left a Huber facility. Under Chambers and Begay, none of those would qualify for the three predicates that he would need for the Armed Career Criminal Act. So that's really the first thing that it did. I don't think that there's any bad faith in that. Once Chambers came down, I knew that I'd have to file a habeas petition. There was an open question as to whether it would apply retroactively or not. That seems to have been resolved that it will. So the law has certainly cleaned up in that respect. We filed it within 1 year of Chambers and put it out there. I went to the Waukesha Circuit Court, and I pulled out, I guess they're called the Shepherd documents, the criminal information, the complaint. I attached them in the brief to basically show that this was not a prison breakout. This was a walk away from essentially a place that involved work release privileges. So that's the first thing that the petition does. The second thing it does is it eliminates the claims with regard to the discharge certificate, which is, you know, what caused all the problem in this case in the first place, because he's been already convicted, or at least a jury found against him that those were fraudulent, that he suborned perjury, et cetera. We dropped those claims in the amended petition. So,
yeah, and that's evident when Mr. Vetrano had the opportunity to respond to the,
right.
to the government's response. We
voluntarily dismissed
him. So
yes.
What you call the amended petition really is, seems to me, to be a substitute. It's replacing the original petition involving these forged documents with an entirely different petition. It doesn't seem to be a supplement.
I could have done it in two steps. We could have filed an amended petition including the discharge certificates, and then we could have filed a motion to drop the claims with respect to the discharge certificates. We did it in one step instead of two steps. But again, I don't think that any court can say that there's bad faith in dropping a meritless claim. And I can't believe that any court would say that there's bad faith in bringing a valid claim under recent Supreme Court law, which dramatically changed the law of the Armed Career Criminal Act. So neither one of the changes, it seems to me, involve any bad faith, and yet somehow putting them together creates bad faith. And that, for me, is the biggest part, because obviously I signed my name to the motion. I signed my name he obviously endorsed the amended petition. We put it out there. I don't see where the bad faith would be. I mean, again, I don't see bad faith in bringing a Chambers claim. I think it would be legal malpractice if I didn't.
Well, is it a Chambers claim or is it a Begay claim?
Well, there's both.
Begay made it pretty clear that the residual clause was to be viewed differently than it had before, and as the government suggests, that was notice to your client that if he was going to submit amend his petition, that it would his clock started running then.
Well, Your Honor, I agree. I think that that probably is a fair statement of what the law is. I read a Begay. I read it as limited to crimes which did not involve any mens rea, like an involuntary. I did not read it as saying anything less than first-degree intentional no longer qualifies as a crime of violence. And obviously, a lot of people read it the same way I did, because you had a case like Chambers going up to the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, clearly, the attorneys representing the Department of Justice in that case didn't say, oh, Begay just resolved everything here. But notwithstanding that, Chambers was obviously a change with respect to the escape statute. And if the escape conviction that he has does not qualify under the Armed Career Criminal Act, he doesn't qualify as an Armed Career Criminal Act. He's facing a 10-year maximum sentence. He's already served, I think it's over 12 now. So from that standpoint, as I see it, I think that even under Chambers, we'd be timely with respect to the escape statute. I mean, clearly, the Chambers came from the Seventh Circuit, and Chambers lost in the Seventh Circuit. And we did file within 1 year of Chambers. So, again, from my standpoint, when I take a look at what the judge did, I don't see the bad faith in bringing the motion. And furthermore, I don't see anything in Rule 15 or the other cases that say that there has to be a related requirement. If you amend the complaint to add claims, to substitute claims, to drop claims, there's no issue of it being germane. There is with respect to relation back under the statute of limitations, but that has nothing to do with what we're talking about here. So from that standpoint, I don't see that as being a material difference. And again, once Chambers came down, a motion to amend had to be brought. Not to do it would be legal malpractice. And I would think that there's no question that the court should be that a court could find that he acted in bad faith in filing the initial petition based on these discharge certificates, in which there's a lot of evidence that suggests that they were dummied up, which was before I got involved in the case, obviously. But notwithstanding that, dropping those cases should not be bad faith.
What if he'd filed a successive habeas, alleging new Supreme Court?
You have to file it within 1 year, and we filed within 1 year of Chambers.
You filed something within 1 year, right, of Chambers, and you filed the other thing within 1 year of Chambers, right?
We filed our amended habeas and the motion to amend within 1 year of Chambers being decided.
If in hindsight, obviously, if you at least tried to get a move for a successive habeas based on the new Supreme Court ruling, would that have been a better approach?
Well, my understanding is that the only way you could get that is if the Supreme Court ruled that it was retroactive on appeal, which it seems to be highly unlikely. So we would get it. It's a difference between 522H and 2255H and 2255F. Essentially, we're under our first habeas. Okay. And under our first habeas, it just has to be retroactive. It doesn't have to be retroactive by the U.S. Supreme Court.
So that was the basis of that decision, then.
Right, exactly.
Because it wasn't going to be retroactive, as opposed to you had to go back to square one where you were timely, I guess, or whatever you want to call it, as opposed to attempting a habeas, habeas.
The Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act raised the bar for a second habeas, and it made it very high. If Mr. Vetrano is not allowed to pursue this claim, then it, by all rights, the only other option that he'd have would be to go under some sort of fundamental miscarriage of justice, an innocent man in prison. And I believe that in the Seventh Circuit, under In re Davenport, those can be brought under 2241. But of course, Mr. Vetrano's not in the Seventh Circuit, and I don't think that he'd have any remedy whatsoever. So really, this is the remedy that he'd be looking for.
You described the escape here as a walkaway, but the complaint makes it sound a little more serious than that, where the correctional officer opens up his locker, he says, I'm out of here, takes off, and is pursued by other correctional officers. That sounds more like a real escape than a walkaway.
The distinction that I've been seeing in the escape cases has been, are you behind a locked door and you break out, or are you not behind a locked door? He returned to the Huber facility. he realized that he was going to get in trouble because I think he had some drinks or something, turned around and left. He did not, you know, escape through another. He was not readmitted to the facility. He was not in prison garb. He had just entered it. The real issue is
pursued by the correctional officers raises this question of risk of harm to them and others during that pursuit, which seems to...
Well, I think that Chambers resolved that particular issue when they looked at the walk away. He did not break out of jail. He had not been readmitted. They knew that he was supposed to return and that he was at the facility, turned around and left. But that's something that we'd welcome on it, that should be addressed on the merits. I mean, obviously, it's something that judges could disagree on. But when I take a look at the Shepherd documents, I certainly don't see anything there that would suggest that it's violence. I think that with Chambers, that it's reasonably clear that it's there.
It doesn't have to be violent in and of itself. It has to pose
a substantial risk of violence.
Right. Risk of violence, like the listed crimes.
And that's true. However, the U.S. Supreme Court also suggested that you're trying to categorize this by looking at what category it's in rather than analyzing the individual facts of the particular case. So from that standpoint, I think that you'd categorize this as a walkaway. He wasn't in a secure facility. He was in a non-secure portion of the building and left.
When you caught up with him, was there any resistance or any problem?
My understanding that there wasn't, but again, the case will be based on the documents from that criminal case, the information, the complaint. I attached them to that. That's what I could find. I don't know if there's a more extensive file that Madison might have, but that's what would be there. It's not something that we'd be relying on Mr. Petrano's testimony. And again, the issue is not what happened. The question is how was it classified? I'd like to save the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Gordon Jim Pietro. I'm an assistant United States attorney in Milwaukee, and I represent the United States on this appeal. I actually also represented the United States on the prior three appeals in this case, two on direct appeal, and this is now the second on 2255. I'd like to organize my argument today into the three sections really that are at dispute here. The first is the question of whether Judge Randa abused his discretion in denying the motion to amend. And then the other two are issues that we've raised as possible alternative grounds to affirm his decision, the timeliness question and then with respect to the merits. And so before I get to those three arguments, I want to address briefly some aspects of the reply brief that obviously I haven't had a chance to talk about yet, and I think that they are key to go into the arguments that I do want to make. There's one aspect of the reply brief that is raised but is really irrelevant, and that's this question of procedural default and retroactivity. The Department of Justice has never taken a position with respect to Begay and Chambers that they are not substantive, they are not retroactive, and so as a result, we have not argued procedural default in this case. So that's not really the question at all. So that part of the reply brief, I think, can be set to the side. The other thing about the reply brief that I think sets up my arguments on timeliness is that Mr. O'Reilly goes right into the merits of his the three predicates to talk about Chambers and Begay, et cetera. But in doing so, he walks himself, it seems to me, right into our timeliness argument. If you look at his reply brief, what he argues with respect to the two endangering safety convictions and why these two convictions are not violent felonies, is he cites Smith and he cites McDonald. And both of those cases are decisions of this court that rely on Begay. They don't at all rely on Chambers. So if you look at the two endangering safety convictions that are at issue, before you get to the merits, you have to decide the timing question. And I think in his reply brief, by citing Begay as the basis for that challenge, the challenge to those two convictions, he walks himself right into the one-year limitation under 2255 F3. So that aspect of the reply brief, I think, is incredibly helpful for my alternative argument on timing. Same thing is true with respect to the escape conviction that he argues is substantively not a violent felony. And he cites this court's decision in Templeton. Now, why is that significant? Templeton is a case decided by this court shortly after Begay. It deals expressly with a Wisconsin escape conviction. And this court in Templeton recognized that Begay changed the landscape with respect to categorizing escape convictions. So while Mr. O'Reilly in his reply brief wants to talk about the merits, again, of now the escape conviction, he cites this court's decision in Templeton. As the court knows, and I think it's granted my motion yesterday to use a demonstrative exhibit today to talk sort of about the timeline. And I hope Your Honors have that exhibit that I filed yesterday in front of you.
We don't have it in front of us, as a matter of fact. I did authorize it, but it's not.
May I approach and provide those
to you?
Yes.
Counsel have.
Oh, yes. Again, I had talked about setting my argument into three different categories. The issue of the motion to amend, Judge Randa's decision, his discretion, the timing issue, and then the substantive, the merits of these arguments. What this exhibit does, I think, pretty clearly is it shows the sequence of the 2255 litigation and the decisions of the Supreme Court and then this court as you're moving forward. And as I was indicating, you see the Begay decision is in April of 2008, and this court in Templeton and Smith, soon thereafter, September of 2008, just a number of months later, citing Begay, this court said that a Wisconsin escape conviction may not count as a violent felony. It said in Smith that recklessness may not count under Begay. And so this is exactly why we're arguing as an alternative basis that this proposed amended habeas filed in January of 2010 is untimely under 2255F3. And so looking at this chronology, you see that prior to Chambers, this court certainly recognized that there was a question under the ACCA as to whether or not specifically a Wisconsin escape conviction and also recklessness crimes qualified as violent felonies. So it's our contention that even before Chambers, defendants are on notice. If you're going to challenge as a substantive matter your ACCA predicate, either because it's an escape-type conviction or a recklessness crime, you've got 1 year in which to do so. And so I think by focusing on, in his reply brief, the merits of his case, he's walked himself right into our timing argument, which is it wasn't Chambers that started the one-year clock. It was actually Begay. And so I would just point out, too, for the record, that Mr. Vetrano was pro se in March of 2008. Counsel was appointed in August of 2008. And so you look at this chronology and you see, unlike most pro se defendants, or unlike most defendants who are coming into federal court under 2255, you know, Mr. Vetrano had counsel, and I think a fair reading of Templeton and Smith at that time would have indicated, gee, now is the time to amend this 2255 and add these new claims under Begay. I think it's also important to note, again, getting to this timing question, why it should be Chambers that starts the clock. Chambers dealt with a failure to report conviction under Illinois law. It wasn't the Wisconsin escape conviction that's at issue here. And I agree with Mr. O'Reilly that this court is not supposed to look at the actual conduct that took place with respect to the escape. You have to categorize that offense for purposes of the ACCA. And if you look at the decision in Chambers, you see that the court sort of analyzed failures to report, and then it analyzed, separated them out from flights from secure custody, and I think critically, flights from the presence of law enforcement. That's a category of escape that even after Chambers, as a categorical matter, is still a crime of violence. And again, we're struggling a little bit in this court with the Woods divisibility analysis, and maybe I'm getting a little too far into the weeds on this issue, but it seems to me if you look at the Shepard-approved documents in this case, if you're permitted to do so, this is not a Chambers escape. This is exactly the kind of escape that is carved out of Chambers. And so while we don't think you need to get to the merits as to any of the three convictions because we believe they're untimely, if you do so and you do the proper categorical approach, we believe certainly the escape conviction is categorically a crime of violence. Substantively, too, as I've discussed in the brief, the endangering safety convictions, again, categorically, should be classified as crimes of violence. I discussed in the brief the tension between this court's decision in McDonald and its citation to a Wisconsin Supreme Court called Jensen, in which you could make the argument that recklessness crimes are not crimes of violence under the ACCA. But the difficulty for Mr. Vetrano is his convictions, those two endangering safety convictions, are older. They predate the revisions in the Wisconsin statutes with respect to the recklessness crime. And if you look at the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decisions in Wesso and Hawthorne and Randolph, what you see is a characterization of the crime as something beyond recklessness, something that is more than a recklessness crime. And so I would say if you're going to get to the merits, and we don't believe you need to do so, you have to conclude under Wisconsin law that these two convictions for endangering safety are, in fact, violent felonies under the ACCA. So that's sort of I went to the last thing, which is the merits. I think I should talk. We talked about the timing. I'll talk a little bit about, of course, the key first question is Judge Randa's decision and his discretion in denying the motion to amend. And we think under an abuse of discretion standard, this was an entirely reasonable decision on his part not to grant the motion to amend. And so we think the simplest way to resolve this case is to simply affirm his exercise of discretion and agree that it was appropriate to deny the motion to amend. I don't think, as Mr. O'Reilly is saying, that Judge Randa focused and said because Mr. Vetrano did something wrong by filing what is, I think, clearly a fraudulent petition, it's that on that basis I'm going to deny your motion to amend. I think that overstates what Judge Randa said. I think what he said is this is not really an amendment in any fair sense of that word. This is an entirely new course. This is an entirely new theory. And what's bad faith is you're calling it an amendment under Rule 15, but it's not. It's not at all. And that's really what animated his original decision to characterize it as a second or successive, which brought us here the first time on 2255.
Would a timely motion to amend been appropriate?
Within a year of Begay?
Mm-hmm.
I think if he had filed it in within a year of Begay, perhaps, that would have been, I think, an indication that there wasn't bad faith here. But you have to look at the box that Mr. Vetrano had put himself in. He filed this fraudulent document. He gets indicted by a grand jury in connection with those fraudulent documents. And he doesn't want to make any concessions whatsoever in the 2255 that his first petition is fraudulent. So he sits back. He waits. And that's the other basis for Judge Randa's ruling, dilatory motive.
So he had basically no choice.
Essentially, yes. So but excuse me, Judge.
Well, I'm just saying, with us, that second charge facing him, he can't go in and make an admission of guilt, I guess, is what you're saying.
And I think that's the box that he put himself in. And I think if you would go back to pre-ADPA cases, this would sort of be an abuse of the writ sort of a situation. And this case is sort of unique, right? I can foresee many cases, and we understand from this court's decisions, that ordinarily, right, a defendant gets an opportunity, a single shot, to just add claims and drop claims as appropriate. And that's a fair reading of this court's precedent, and we don't quibble with that under Rule 15. The difficulty is this is sort of a unique case. It stands on its own. And that's why you really can't find Judge Randa abused his discretion, because it's perfectly reasonable to say, look, this is too much. This first petition that you wedded yourself to is fraudulent entirely. You preserve no aspect of it. It's not an amendment. This is simply a new theory. And that's sort of borne out by what happened after Judge Randa in this case denied the motion to amend. Rather than defend in any way, right, the original fraudulent petition, he moved to voluntarily dismiss it.
What about, I asked before, and this may be completely off base, about the possibility of filing a second successive based on Chambers?
It's virtually impossible for these reasons. I think, as Mr. O'Reilly has indicated, it's not just that it has to be a decision of the United States Supreme Court under 2255H. Well, the retroactivity would be less of a problem because the Department of Justice is acknowledging retroactivity. Yeah. It's not just a decision of the Supreme Court. It also has to be a constitutional issue. And the ACCA is a statute.
Okay.
And so he's got really two significant hurdles to try to get a second or successive authorized.
Okay.
And again, I would say that's the position he put himself in, right? That is a consequence of his conduct. Now, I acknowledge, as Mr. O'Reilly has argued, well, he suffered the consequences. He was indicted and convicted in connection with that original fraudulent petition. That's not the only consequence from our perspective, and Judge Randa was entirely right, it seems to me, to say this amendment is not an amendment. You're bringing this to avoid the consequences of your action, not to fix or update a legitimate petition. And that's really why the two cases that Mr. O'Reilly relied on in his appeal here are not 2255 cases. And they actually are cases in which the original complaint was not at all, you know, just sort of walked away from. It was improved or fixed or amended. That's not this situation. And 2255, you know, as Mr. O'Reilly recognized, Congress significantly tightened up the screws here in an effort to avoid sort of ongoing litigation. And so if there's a harshness here, it's a harshness or it's a stringency that Congress created, and it was exacerbated by Mr. Vetrano's own conduct in pursuing what was clearly a fraudulent initial petition.
Has he been sentenced on the fraudulent documents case yet?
He has not, Judge. We have asked Judge Edelman on two occasions to do so. His attorney in that case has opposed him being sentenced, so we are sort of at a standstill in that case. So I see my time has expired if there are no further questions.
Anyone else charged in that forgery case?
No. The other, the co-actor, Scott Valona, was a cooperator and testified against Mr. Vetrano. Thank you very much.
Mr. Wright, how much time does it? 3 minutes, Mr. Wright.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, I'd like to just make really 2 points. The first point is with respect to timeliness. And I'm sure that the government, of course, is going to argue that from Begay, the judicial foresight is going to extend forever, and that if you didn't do something by Begay, you're over. But that's not the way I saw it. I don't think that's the way many people saw it. After Begay, there was still an open question about these statutes, in which covered both intentional conduct, which had violent possibilities such as a jailbreak, and sort of walkaway offenses. It wasn't clear how that was going to break down. I do think that the case law is now clear that if you are breaking out from a non-secure location, that is not a crime of violence. It's only if you're in a secured facility, if you're in a jail, if you've already been admitted to that, that does become a crime of violence. That seems to be the way the case law has shaken out. The date should be triggered from Chambers, not from Begay, certainly for the Wisconsin escape statute. The second point, with respect to the motion to amend, the hallmark of when interest requires is prejudice. The government has not been prejudiced whatsoever. And to tell you the truth, throughout this case, I've been facing the shifting sands. First, it's bad faith, then it's timeliness, jurisdictional issues, et cetera. I would like to get all the arguments in one battle and fight them. But clearly, I think that it's something that if this court is going to affirm Judge Randa with respect to the bad faith, that it would come directly in contrast with Griggs versus Pace America and the True Point decisions that I cited in my brief. Those decisions clearly hold bad faith in the case is not sufficient. You need bad faith in bringing the motion. And habeas cases are supposed to be treated under Rule 15 just like other cases. Johnson versus U.S. by this court made that same point. There should not be a separate rule for habeas cases. I don't think that this case is as unique as the government seems to think. Fraudulent documents and suborning perjury do happen in cases. And then the final point that I'd simply make is that in my mind, I did not see that these claims are so unrelated. It's a minor point, but the initial one said that the violation did not qualify for ACA purposes.
On a totally false basis, though.
I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm not making. I can't concede the point, but I can't.
For which he's
but nevertheless,
convicted.
It did not qualify under the ACA. That argument was supplemented with an alternative argument that same violation did not qualify under the ACCA.
I'm not sure that helps
one
you on
the other.
The bad faith. If you really think they're related, I'm not sure that helps.
That's in my mind. That I thought that was significant. So, I mean, obviously this case for me has been an ethical minefield. I've never had a client who's been indicted while I've been representing them. I was actually subpoenaed as a witness in the criminal case. So, you know, I've had to get several ethics opinions just to figure out what I'm doing in this particular case. But in my mind, that's what was significant. So thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. O'Reilly. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.